from the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada. It's Midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marsha Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Skills Hudson, as the problem guy.
Good morning. Good evening. Hello. How you doing? Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse, where we get together at that witching hour between day and night, yesterday and today and tomorrow, and kind of ease into a whole new day. Welcome. We have a wonderful show tonight. We kind of teased it last week with Monique, and so I want you to meet my guest. She's an amazing woman, and you're going to enjoy it. But before we get into that, we have to do our ritual that we always do. I like to have a little cannabis and cognac before we get started, because once a week, I like to treat myself. And so this week, we're going to have some Martell VSOP. You see that? I don't make a dime from showing y'all all this cognac. Somebody need to give me some money. But anyway, I'm going to have just a little short one. I want you to see it so people who think, yeah, she be drinking every week, she must be drinking. Just enough to wet my whistle. And for cognac, we're back to this little stizzy vape. It's not a disposable. It has a little cartridge like that. You put that in there. And then mother passes out. All right. Here's to you. Here's to us. Here's to hoping we get through this. Because now we get into the meat of the thing. I got shit to say. We are in crisis. For some reason, people decided to elect a person they knew was incompetent and criminal. And somehow they believe he's going to save. He ain't going to save nothing. He can't even save money. He can't even pay people. So I don't know what this delusion is. I do know what it is. I'm going to explain it. But it's like, it's so hard to fathom that adults, supposedly capable of taking care of themselves and washing their own ass, would actually vote for a person like Donald Trump. However, he's not the whole problem. You know, there are a lot of factors at work here. He's basically a useful stooge with a megalomaniacal ego. He says he is the law. He's actually said that. He said, he who saves the country does not violate any law. Now, it's supposed to be a quote from Napoleon. And so he thinks he's Napoleon. He's not even a Napoleon or nothing. Anyway, people voted for this man who is a racist. He's a sexist, pussy-grabbing, convicted felon. And he's a stooge. We don't know who exactly he's a stooge for. It might be Putin. It might be Musk. It might be the Heritage Foundation or some other entity that has his claws in him enough to move him around like a chess piece. But he's not the one pulling strings. He, the first time he was president, stumbled through COVID, created a lot of the economic issues that we currently live with, that Biden-Harris tried to clean up to no bigot. Well, to a lot of avail, but he's back to reinfect us with his incompetence. He incited riots against supposedly his own government. And in effect, he put a hit out on his own vice president. We know all that. But his allegiance is and his agenda is not the same as, say, the Heritage Foundation. It's more akin to the Klan, which some people say, yeah, six of one, half dozen. But Donald Trump wants fealty, loyalty, and to stay out of jail. He also likes praise. So what he wants basically is to be not just Donald, he wants to be a Don. He wants to be the Godfather. He can't even play one on TV, but that's what he thinks he is. He wants all his people to kiss his ring. He wants all his enemies dealt with, you know, like, you know, Trump-a-Leone. He's insane. But the Heritage Foundation and the Project 2025, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. They've been planning this. You could trace the roots of this plan back to the Civil War. They want to avenge the loss of nationwide white supremacy in their mind. Now, of course, they've always maintained it through various any means necessary kind of thing. But they want to have this coup and take over and govern with the small, stingy government that maintains white supremacy at the top. So it's in effect the big lie of the big lie. It's the desire, and not just the desire, to plan to enshrine white supremacy as the law of the land and make everybody else's place clearly delineated in the pyramid of who's up on top and who's at the bottom. So to maintain that, you have to, if you're at the top and you want to maintain that supremacy, you have to keep the people at the bottom fighting. Otherwise, they'll all get together and realize you're manipulating them, and they'll get together and overthrow you. And you'll have another Bacon's Rebellion or something like that, which they said, oh, no, we must now forever keep the races, the genders, everybody separate, because we don't want another Haitian Revolution. So you have to, if you're going to do that and keep people fighting, to, in order to have an advantage, you have to have at least a large faction on your side who's willing to fight for you, not just for themselves. And so they invented whiteness. So now these people who at one time were fighting with each other over everything and had been fighting forever, now they're all American white. And they have, according to them, they have dominion over everyone as ordained by white Jesus. So that's why we have the evangelicals and all of this stuff and everybody banding together to maintain that superior image. Now, you don't have to be, if you're at the top, you don't have to be a Christian, whatever. You just have to keep the people right below you thinking that that's what they're fighting for. And so Irish Americans and Italian Americans and Polish Americans and Cuban, as long as they have white skin and fair hair, they can be considered white and at the top of the pyramid. They're the real Americans. They had nothing to do with the revolution. They had nothing to do with nothing. But, and they're all immigrants too. But somehow when we get here, they're not nationality based. They are white. And that's, you know, crap. But if you can get people to believe it, a lie is just as good as the truth. Flip Wilson said that. And so if you can connect all these people on a whole lot of bases, religion, economy, race, gender, whatever, and convince them that the darker huddled masses are savage demons determined to eliminate you, then and rape their women and take all their stuff, you can get them to do pretty much anything. And in that backdrop, we get the great replacement theory that all these people are plotting against you to take over and do to you what you did to them. It's horseshit. It's always been horseshit. Nobody has ever said, I want to be over white people. They said, stop fucking with us. That's all. That's all. Just stop fucking with us and everything will be cool. But that's too much of a threat. So they have to maintain supremacy or you won't have a country anymore. You remember that? Remember Trump said that? You won't have a country anymore because the minorities will take over and take your place. So when they say there are not enough white babies being born, well, you have to ban abortion. You have to control the women. You have to maintain that state religion. God said that you shall not da-da-da-da-da. When you say there are too many brown people, you have to make them all pet-eating, racist, Willie Horton-esque boogeymen who are just out to take your stuff that they haven't earned. And so when with the election of Barack Obama, who just wouldn't stay in his place like he promised, because he had to promise not to be too black or he never would have been elected. But when he was elected and then was on occasion just a little too black, then that was seen like as the first sign of the white apocalypse. So the idea of electing a black woman who didn't seem as eager to acquiesce to that I'm only so black thing, that was just too damn much. And it happened with, remember this was around 2018, and then COVID and all this kind of stuff, and then his first term. And in the midst of that, the 1619 Project was published. That fucked everybody up. It shifted the story. It shifted the narrative from white people did everything. They invented everything. They even invented you. So not only must you stay in your place, you must be grateful to them and all that kind of stuff. It changed everything. And it was too stark. It was too much. It was too much history. All the way up until now, they've controlled the history. This was out of control. She won a Pulitzer. It was being integrated into school systems. It was seen, hailed as a breakthrough. And so that sent the Heritage Foundation into a panic. So what they did was almost immediately, they came up with their own rebuttal, this 1776 Project.
There are those who claim America's true founding was in the year 1619, when African slaves were forced across the Middle Passage to come to the New World. They claim that America is rooted in oppression and racism. These are the claims of the 1619 Project. But the true founding of America happened in 1776. When a group of rebels fought for independence from the British and built America with one idea in mind, freedom for all. Why would anyone want to destroy such a legacy? A legacy of overcoming adversity to form one nation under God, one unhyphenated America.
And if you look through the Project 2025, you'll see references to the 1776 Project. And in fact, they put out a rebuttal that was published in October of 2019. And I think the 1619 Project came out in August of that year. So anyway, they started this whole campaign against everything that they saw the 1619 Project represented. Woke. It couldn't be woke anymore. And Christopher Rufo, this guy, he came out and said that they were launching a war against CRT, critical race theory, because it was indoctrinating school children and making them feel bad about being white. And no such thing was happening. CRT was not being taught in grammar school. Your children would have no knowledge of it unless you told them, which would not really be a bad thing because, you know, once you get past the uncomfortable moment, if everybody understands the genesis of everything, you can get past it. But that's too much like right. So they turned CRT into a euphemism for Black and Black inclusion in American history. And woke and CRT, pretty much synonymous. Then they came out with this Prager University. And Dennis Prager is a TV some dude, and he started making Lost Cause cartoons that the anti 1619 Project people started using in their school districts. And that's why we want everybody to have their own school district, so we can't all learn the same history and be on the same page, because then we might all get together and go, hey, you guys with all the money, y'all full of shit. So we can't let that happen. And they have all these happy Lost Cause kind of videos narrated by Candace Owens and all kind of conservative heroes. And they want to correct the record that the founding fathers were not racist and didn't enshrine racism into the Constitution. They were just slave owners. Somehow this makes sense in their head, but that's the kind of thing they put out. And people who've been taught this their whole life don't feel like they have any reason to question it. So these got to be our patriots. And the Prager University cartoons, they push this happy darky narrative that these noble founding fathers and other slave owners loved their enslaved people. They just loved them and they were happy. And the enslaved people were happy to be loved by these benevolent slave owners who horribly oppressed them and branded them with hot irons and called them their property. He was just happy and singing and dancing. In other words, I wrote this down. It was piles of happy horse shit about people owning seditionist losers, complete with a plethora of monuments and statues to remind us all of their greatness, nobility, and righteous supremacy. And this backlash to the truth is the basis of the Heritage Project. They are making Blackness illegal. They are making femininity illegal. They want that control written into law, because when you write it into law or when you write a thing down, that makes it real. In white America, if it's not written down, it didn't happen. So what they did was they took the pens and pencils from people who could write counter narratives. And in a lot of ways, a lot of the things they're trying to enact are trying to do that again. Take the pens out of your hand, or the keyboards, make them so that the things you type will never be seen. And so we have to kind of remain aware of what this narrative is, what this purpose is, or else these Lost Cause proponents will enshrine anti-Blackness and take away our books and our museums, stores, all the things that contain comprehensive American history. So keep promoting the 1619 Project. Keep celebrating DEI and woke, and stay woke. Keep talking. Do not let them take your voice and write it down. Preserve your own narrative. Preserve your history. We here would love for you to tell us your family story as much as you want to share. Let's have as many records as possible and preserve our museums, because they're going to start taking funding from all of them, all of the Black History museums and cultural places will be choked, with the hope that the life will be taken out of it. And whatever we can do to counter that, we can do. But we must, I think, not lose. It's not hope. Not lose the sense of your power. You have power. You don't have to take any of this. I don't care what the people are saying. You can fight. If people could fight their way out of Indian schools and plantations and all of the oppressed people who have risen above and met the challenge, we can fight through this. So that's my rant. I approve this message, and we're going to get it on to lighter and happier subjects. Maybe, maybe not. My guest tonight was featured last week in absentia. She wasn't here, but Monique, who was, introduced her name into the conversation as someone who she, in her words, she was ashamed that she didn't know who this woman is. And so she said she's made it her mission to tell the world who my next guest is. And I'm going to bring her out and let her tell you who she is, because you need to know. Please welcome Sylvia Traymore Morrison. Hi, honey.
Hey, Marcia, how you doing?
I'm fine, how are you?
I loved your rant just now. I can't tell you how much I loved your rant. That was absolutely right up my alley. Thank you for that.
I'm glad you liked it. So, are you drinking with me tonight?
You know what? I think you might even laugh at this, but I really can't drink, and don't even give me a joint, please, because it might cause Trump to step down.
Okay.
But all I right. did bring this little. A friend of my friends gave me this. It's called a cranberry chiller.
Okay.
And from what I hear, I haven't tasted it or tried it yet. Once you drink it, you need to go somewhere and sit down and shut all the windows and everything and just enjoy it.
Release the demons. Well, yeah. Use your own discretion with that. Now, I know some of your history, but I want to hear it from you. So let's start at the beginning. Okay. What made you want to be an impressionist?
You know, I never really wanted to be one. It just was my journey. When I first realized impressions, I could hear things. I could hear crickets. Not only could I hear them from a distance, I could make the same sound. I could hear the flapping of a butterfly's wings. I knew when they were nearby. I would tell,
all right.
tell my sister.
All right. You got to do a cricket talking to a butterfly, because I want to hear that.
Well, now, on another note, the voice that I had when I was 9 has changed dramatically. So certain
say no more.
Sounds,
say no more.
Yeah. But I liked, and then I realized I could imitate people in my neighborhood. I could look just like them, act just like them, talk just like them, just become people.
Okay.
And it was a little fascinating because people are like, how do you do that? Well, I didn't know. I just did it. I could hear you talking. I could make your sounds. As a matter of fact, I'm finishing up on my Marshall Warfield impression. So yeah, you have characteristics, honey. Yours are so clear. And I even told a friend, I told Andy, I said, I've got Wanda Sykes down, because now when I do Wanda Sykes on stage, people go nuts. You know, they go, oh my God, it's just like her. And but getting back to when I first started, there were no television shows that housed a lot of Black people. You know, we had one or two here and there. I think almost every Black family back in the day, if you saw a Black person on TV, you went bananas. You went and got the whole family. It's a Black, it's a colored person on TV. It's some colored person. So
what year are we talking?
In the 50s. So the one or two Black people that I'm trying to remember who, one of the first ones I saw, you know, when Motown brought out the Supremes, I started sounding, looking and acting like Diana Ross. Okay. So I created a group. And people would say, what's the name of your group? And I'd say, it's the Supremes. Now, I'm a little girl. I don't know any better. And they're like, you can't name your group the Supremes, because there's already a group called the Supremes. And I would do my Diana Ross impression. And people would laugh and say, so that's why you want to name your group the Supremes.
The Little Supreme.
Yeah. We really were Little Supremes. And but I could do imitations, but there weren't that many Black people to do imitations of. So
but when you were doing these, were you at school? Are you in church? Are you, where are you performing these impressions?
Marsha, anywhere except for stage. And that's what led me to try to find a platform, because nobody could see me but my neighbors and my family. I didn't know where to go to let people see that I could do Jane Hathaway from the Beverly Hillbillies, Mr. Clawford, Jethro, Ellie Mae, you know. So it was a challenge for me. How am I going to get to be seen?
Right.
Where am I going to go? I was too young to go in the clubs, but I was, according to people, good enough to be on national TV. But how do you get on national TV was the question. So,
how did you get on national TV?
I was watching the Flip Wilson show one day, and these Black girls came out on the stage. And Marsha, they were beautiful. They were classy. They were stylish. They were wonderful. And they talked about they were in a pageant, the Miss Black America pageant, because they couldn't enter the Miss America pageant because rule number 7 at that time said the only way you can be in this pageant is you have to be Caucasian. So J. Morris Anderson created the Miss Black America pageant, so that Black girls had an opportunity to be in a pageant.
What year? And what year?
That was 1968, I think it was. 1968.
Yeah, that was thinking 68, 69. The Black Pearl was the first song I remember celebrating Black women's special, separate beauty. And that Black women were beautiful. This was a, you know, we're coming into the beginning of the Black Power movement.
Absolutely. And then,
so there's right after the Civil Rights Movement. So there's a lot of change happening, a lot of representation happening that wasn't happening before.
Absolutely.
So now, at this time, how old are you?
48. No. I'm 72.
No. How old were you then?
I was 19. I think I was 18 or 19. Yeah.
So, budding young woman, you.
Yes.
Here's about a pageant for Black women.
Yes.
At a time when there was no such thing. What did you do?
I entered the pageant. Now, when I entered the pageant, I didn't think because I can win, because I'm beautiful, because I entered that pageant expressly for the platform it offered. It offered a national platform. And I figured if I could get on that platform, people could see that this young Black girl was doing a talent that no other Black girl that I knew of at the time could do.
Right.
And I got in the pageant and it served me well. I ended up tying for first place with Bernadette Stanis, who was Thelma from Village.
Walking in tall cotton right there.
And as a matter of fact, that one night when we were competing, they gave her a card to go and audition for Thelma. And they sent me to Europe to entertain the American troops from the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And which was...
Was that a Bob Hope tour or a USO tour?
It was like the USO tour. Yeah, okay. We did the USO tour. Now, by that time, I had perfected my Diana Ross impression, and I started doing Tina Turner. Now, at that time, I had a lot of wind. I had a lot of movement. I had all kind of, I could do Tina Turner.
Right.
And it just caught the attention of a famous comedian back home in the States. And he said, you know, when she gets back to the States, fly her out here to California, because I want to see her. I want to see her live. And that man was Red Fox. So Mr. Fox signed me to a contract, to a management contract.
Okay.
He's the only manager, official manager I've ever had in my life. So
did it turn out to be fruitful? And
he had started, I think he had just started doing Sanford and Son. So he was unbelievably busy.
Right.
And I didn't get a chance to really go out on the road with him or do none of that stuff. But what happened is I learned about the Comedy Store while I was in L.A. And so I went and got in line one day when they, you know, give you 2 or 3 minutes on stage. I said, that's all I need. That's all I need. Just give me 2 or 3 minutes. And I was doing Cher. I was doing Lily Tomlin. I was doing, you know, most of them were white girls because I didn't see anybody, none of us.
Right.
On stage. And it was cool, you know, because they captured the audiences, because most of the audiences I finally got a chance to go in front of were all white people. So yeah, they loved Cher. Yeah, they loved Lily Tomlin. Yes, they loved all of the ladies that I was doing, Joan Rivers and the crew. So it was fascinating being in Europe, but more fascinating when I got back to the States and Red Fox flew me out there.
But now that's the question. Then the next question I have, Red had a club, Red Fox. Uh-huh. Did you work there?
No, I never got a chance to work there. I never really got a chance to actually be managed by Red Fox. He had me in his, he had signed about, I think, I don't know, quite a few people. I know, what's her name? LaWanda Page was under his management. There was about 2 or 3 of them that I knew. But I also didn't know, because of not having any knowledge about the entertainment industry. My contract was for 35 years. I didn't know. I couldn't afford a lawyer to look at the contract. I just signed it. I didn't care. At that time, I was signing a contract with Red Fox.
So you're still under contract to Red Fox.
No, you know what? I just got released. I had the years figured out, because TV One did a session on him, did one of those unsung things, I think. And the woman who worked for him, she has all of the paperwork that we did back then in the early 70s. So it was, yeah, the early 70s. Because by the time I went to Europe and came back, it was like 73, 74, whatever. So I want to get my contract. I want to get a copy of the contract that I signed.
Okay.
And I think it's still out there in his building.
And frame it, preserve it, put it in the Sylvia Museum. So after you started and started working, where did you find places to work? Where did you finally find the consistent stage time?
You know what? And I went to the Comedy Store, Mitzi Shore, as those of us who go back there, we know
Sylvia. Sylvia.
Look at you. Look at you doing it. You sound like her. Oh, my God. So I finally got in one night and I got my 3 minutes on stage and she sent someone over to tell me that she wanted to speak to me. So I went over and she says, you know, you're very good. I like what I saw. And I think what I'd like for you to do is to go out to the West Hollywood store and bring me a set back here so we can put you on the big stage. Now, I had no clue what that woman was talking about. What is the Hollywood store? What is that? What is the West Hollywood place? But
so you were in Westwood?
I went to Westwood. I wasn't living in Westwood. I was living in the Wilshire district.
But the first night you went up was in Westwood.
No, it was on what is that, Hollywood Boulevard? What's the
okay? The West Hollywood one. That's why I was confused.
Oh, okay. I give them. That's some years ago. Good Lord! So I have to.
I know.
Make
I
sure there. I have to remember. And so my dad got sick, and he was back on the East Coast. He got really sick. And they didn't think he'd make it, which he didn't. So I had to come back home. And I didn't want to go back to California because I didn't want to leave my mom. I'm the youngest in the family. There's six of us. And I didn't want to leave. I felt like I was responsible for my mom. I didn't want to leave her by herself. So I moved to New York.
Okay.
So I could drive back and forth. You know, it was only like 3 or 4 hours. And when I got to New York, none of the white boys that were running clubs would give me any time on stage. And at that time, they were giving you 3 minutes. You know, you go up, you do your 3 minutes, you come down your fence. But just every week, I could never get on. Nobody would ever let me on stage. And I had to attribute it to, I'm a black girl. They won't let me come on the stage. And so finally, I went to a place called Catch a Rising Star. And the host was Jerry Seinfeld.
Okay,
and I'm talking the 70s now, so they hadn't blown up and all that other good stuff. We were all trying to do our thing. Right. And he said, Sylvia, I see you here every week. You just won't quit. So he said, go and take 3 minutes. And Marsha, when I went up there and took them 3 minutes and served them Diana Ross, Tina Turner, I think it was Dionne Warwick maybe? Yeah. And I've always done Cher. Back then, always because I knew people loved Cher, so I always had to put her in my
act. Cher could come to the cookout back then.
She did. Say it again. She what?
I said Cher could have came to the cookout.
Yes, she.
Yeah, she has a standing ovation still. You know.
Yeah. So. And even today, when I bring Cher on stage, you know, it's a pleasant, it's a wonderful feeling because. Especially for the people who remember her from then, you know.
Right.
And but at any rate, Jerry Seinfeld, he was like, oh, man, I would have been letting you come up here had I known what you do. So right. The problem was nobody knew what I did. They just see this girl, you know, and how many black girls were there at the time until I heard about this girl named Marsha Warfield. I said, what? And they said, oh, Sylvia, she the bomb. You know, but you were, I think you were out west. You were still
out west.
Yes, I was
at the Comedy Store. I started at the Comedy Store in 1976. Started doing stand-up in 1974.
74.
In Chicago.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but now, okay, from 1970, boom, 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 you're working, you're going, doing clubs. Doing corporate? Did you do other kinds of shows, like colleges or?
Let me just say this with respect to that question. If I can get your rant out of my head because I loved it so much. Oh my God! You don't know I was sitting over here shaking my head up and down. I'm gonna get to your question, but I just want you to know it really got up here, and I hope it did. I hope it did the same thing to a lot of people who will hear that rant. I've heard you rant before on your show because I watch your show. But thanks. This one tonight was, I think, but that's special for me. No, now
of course, because it there's a tie-in that we're going to get to in a minute. Okay. But before we get there, how do we get to last week? All right? Give me the cliff notes.
So we
from the Comedy Store.
Yeah. And from the Comedy Store, Rodney Dangerfield had a club.
Right.
And so from Catch a Rising Star, I found out about Rodney Dangerfield's club. And that was every Sunday. It was open mic. So that gave me some room to show what I could do. And it's amazing because I was in my living room in New York one day and I saw the newspaper and it said Muhammad Ali was coming to town and they were roasting him with host Richard Pryor. That's the biggest show I'd ever even dreamed of, was seeing Muhammad Ali, who was in his prime. They were roasting him and Richard Pryor was going to be the host. I couldn't.
My heroes.
Looked, and I had a roommate at the time, and she was just beautiful. She's a beautiful woman. She was a high fashion model. She had rented her apartment from Iman, from the model, and I was her roommate. And so I said, I got to go to this roast. I don't know how I'm going to go. I'm not invited, but I'm going. And so I decided I would crash the roast because Marsha, I didn't know anybody. No. I didn't know who I could contact. Maybe get a ticket. No. So I had to make up stuff. So I'm going to the roast and I'm going to crash it. But that was far-fetched because I get a call the day of the roast. Now I'm going to go to that roast. There's the white girl from Laughing. She had a scene where every time the guy would come and get frustrated, she'd pop him upside his head with her purse. Yes, Ruth Bussey. Yes, that's exactly right. So I was going to do my Ruth Bussey because I did an impression of Ruth Bussey. Right. And lo and behold, I get a call from one of the girls I went to Europe with when I was on the USO tour. And she said, Dick Gregory wants you to come in. I said, for what? She said, well, Richard Pryor called today and said he can't make it. And I told him he should get you because you ran Europe when we were over there. She said, you were the talk of the Europeans. And you know, she told him a story about Red Fox flew me out to California. So Mr. Gregory said, bring her in.
Right.
No script, no nothing, Marsha. So here I am Richard wasn't there, but Harry Belafonte, all these names. This was Muhammad Ali's roast. So, you know, everybody was there. Yeah. And I went and, this is when it started getting thick. I hosted the roast. Co-hosted, and at the end of the show, Garrett Morris came over to me, and he said, you've got to meet my boss. And he was at Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
He said, Lorne Michaels going to love you when he sees what you do, because I did a whole series of impressions at the roast.
Right.
It was like a dream come true. I'm hosting the Muhammad Ali roast in place of Richard. I mean, Dick Gregory was such a genius, Marsha, that he didn't get a guy to get to do that, because they would be comparing him to Richard and saying, you know, if Richard had been here, he was Richard Pryor. Right. You know that.
It wasn't without, you know, it's not a girl, it's that girl, you know. So don't sell yourself short on that. I'm pretty
Thank
sure
you. I appreciate that.
He saw who you were and reached out. But now you do that and you get the Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Michaels says to me, he says, Sylvia, every time we try to do a skit on Black women, it goes south. So maybe you can help us with that. You know, we'll bring you in and you can help us with those kind of skits. Well, who cares? Keep in mind, the only contract I ever had was with Red Fox at that. I'm getting ready to go to work for NBC Saturday Night Live. It was hot. This was 1979.
Yeah.
And he brings me in on the spot as an associate writer. Okay. But that I was supposed to help them with writing for Black women's skits. But nobody ever called me in the writing room. Nobody ever gave me an official assignment. The only assignment that was official that I got was Linda Ronstadt and Bob Hope's wife were coming to Saturday Night Live this particular night. And they said, okay, Sylvia, we're going to sign you to Linda Ronstadt and Mrs. Hope. Okay, so what do I do? I mean, what's my job? What happens? So nobody explained it to him because everybody was running around like crazy people. So I just sat down and wrote my own skit of what I think would be good for them to. Right. And quite frankly, it was people that saw it thought it was genius. You know, I took the name Hope and I put I inserted it into Ron's. You know how we do when we create or whatever.
I can imagine. So it worked. And what was the outcome of your time at Saturday Night Live?
Well, again, they never invited me into the writer's room. I did a lot of walking around trying to figure out what was next, going from office to office. I hate to say it, but it's the truth. John Belushi wasn't friendly at all. I didn't really get to hang out or do anything with all the other people, Jane Curtin or none of, you know, it wasn't a fun, like, oh my God, you know.
Did you get paid?
No.
No?
Never got paid. Never.
Never?
Not one time. Not one check.
That's not right. That's not right. So did you watch the 50th anniversary thing?
You know what? After all these years, the 50th anniversary people started following me on social media just this year,
right?
Just like in the last 2 months. And I still don't know why they don't call me to. I guess I didn't stay there long enough. Or I didn't make an impact. Well, I wasn't allowed to make an impact, and I didn't know what to do at that time.
Well, they don't have a really stellar track record of how Black women have been featured on that show. I don't think it's just you. I think that's pretty much been the knock.
I agree.
If there is a knock on Saturday Night Live, that's one of them. But now we could take you through 6,700 years of your career, and we'd be here all week. You were supposed to do a show at the Kennedy Center.
Yes. Yeah.
And a lot of people who have been associated with the Kennedy Center, John DeRimes and others, have
pulled out,
withdrawn and pulled out. And so yours was coming up. Your show was coming up like soon, right?
April 19th.
So now you're here, it's, you know, this thing is happening like it's been, that Donald Trump is taking over and promising to bring back Valkyrie, the kind of marching. So you have a decision to make. What was that like, and what did you decide?
Well, you know what, Marcia, when I first learned that I had a shot at the Kennedy Center, it was really one of the, I'm not going to say on my bucket list. I don't have a bucket list. I probably should create one. I don't know. But appearing at the Kennedy Center is at least where I live here in Washington, D.C., is a big deal. I mean, huge. You don't see women that look like me getting a show at the Kennedy
Center. No, it's good on your resume.
Yes, yes. And so when Steve Bullock, who was a lawyer associated with making that contract, you know, pulling that together, he said, Sylvia, this really is an opportunity. And probably when you're done, you know, a lot of good stuff may happen for you. And I was so excited. You know, I'm doing the Kennedy Center. And I'm working on a documentary as we speak. And I also was going to be doing a comedy special. So it wasn't a comedy show. It was a Sylvia introduction to who Sylvia Tramore Morrison is, in addition to the fact that she's just going to be at the Kennedy Center. So everything in that surrounded my life in the last couple of months have been all about the Kennedy Center. You know, as a matter of fact, they asked me to pick out who I thought could that I wanted to host and co-host for the show, because I had to, you know, we were doing two shows at the Kennedy Center. And so when our president,
your president, My president is at home.
I was looking at that shirt. And I was like, I love that t-shirt. So when he, when I heard on the news that he had decided to come in and take over, so to speak.
Correct.
And then I saw what Shonda Rhimes had just said, no, you know, and then Issa Rae. And I'm like, wait a minute. I can't let these Black women do this and I continue on. And then I got a little bird to tell me that he was going to eliminate all of the current shows coming up. I said, that's it.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not doing it. Not doing it. I want to be on the right side of history. I don't want people saying, well, Sylvia, she was so pressed to be on the Kennedy Center and nobody's buying tickets.
Yeah.
I'd have a 500 seat arena with about 50 people. And I'm trying to tape a comedy special and the rest of my documentary. I said, nah, I can't do it. I can't live with myself knowing that he's fired all these people.
Right.
Added people on the board that are his friends.
Right.
I already knew that once he saw my picture, that was it.
Well, you know, the old one door closes, another door opens. I'm sure there's an open door waiting for you to walk through it. I like I said, we hit some of the high points, but we'll be here all night. And I know, you know, I've imposed on you quite a bit so far. So I want you to meet my comedy sons. We just did a show at the Ice House, and it went wonderfully because they're wonderful. And my oldest son looks just like me. We're going to introduce him with a videotape that he made. He does 2-minute rants that everybody should hear.
Okay.
Hello, this is Stephen Roberts, and this is my 2-minute rant, although it might go a lot longer because, boy, am I pissed right now. Let me tell you something. I had all this other stuff for my rant all ready to go, and then I came in here to have a lovely dinner, which was made by my wonderful husband. Wonderful. I was looking forward to it. It's broccoli and some meat of some kind, some shape, I don't know, and then onion rings. And I thought, oh, ketchup. I would like some ketchup on my onion rings. I sure would. So I took the bottle and I went like this to open it up, and it all came out of my hand. I forced it this time, but look, see the jar? It was all like that. Yes. And I have to tell you, I don't understand who came up with this, where we put the opening at the bottom. Sometimes they have the label upside down. It's like, this is the way it's supposed to go. No, that's not the way it's supposed to go. And of course, somebody, and that would be my husband, had it like this. And so I'm like, oh, that'll be great. And then all over my hand. You know what I'm saying? So now I have to wash my hand. I've wasted ketchup. Everything's wrong in life. And now I'm going to shoot myself in the parking lot. But I have to tell you, this happened the other day with blue cheese dressing. Yes, I like blue cheese dressing, for those of you haters. Anyway, blue cheese dressing, which, by the way, look at the label. The label is upside down so that you keep it like this. There's no way. Look, it comes right out. Who wants blue cheese on their hands? Well, I kind of do, you know. That's good. Anyway, but regular, normal condiments come like this. It's just normal. It comes up. It's small. You cannot do that. And this, of course, thank you, Arby's, for making your bottle correct, right? Mayonnaise. Of course, my mayonnaise is almost gone in good white form. Anyway, you use a knife. Yeah. What are you going to put it underneath? That's ridiculous. And I know they have that, by the way. Yes. All of you who want to write in and say, they make mayonnaise that way. I know. And then salsa, can you imagine putting salsa upside down in a glass bottle? You'd kill yourself. Anyway, that's, and jelly, you wouldn't put, they have squeezable jelly. That's stupid. You can't just, I don't understand. Anyway, got my hands dirty. I'm angry, and now my food is cold.
Okay. Would you please welcome my oldest son, Stephen Roberts. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Mom.
Hi.
Hello, Sylvia.
Hi, how are you?
So I'm good. How did you put the sweetener in your cup? Upside down squeeze bottle, huh? Was it a squeeze bottle?
No, because I got the sugar from the bowl like you're supposed to properly and then put it in.
Anyway, we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
And just hold your horses. What you got in that cup?
This is lemon zinger tea.
Oh. How sweet. Anyway, we're going to talk to Sylvia in a minute, but first I want to bring out...
Hold on. I have to say it's an honor to be in the same show as you, Sylvia. It's such an honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Anyway, he does look exactly like you. He looks just...
He does me. You know, he kind of favors his dad. But, you know, it's a deadbeat dad situation we don't like to talk about. Anyway, my youngest son, it's his birthday. And he is my problem child. But I adore him. And he has a video that we're going to play right now.
What up, famo? Good morning, good afternoon if you're in the afternoon, and good night if you're somewhere at the nighttime. It's your boy Skills, man. I'm here at the crib, Chicago, as you can see. Yeah, it's cold out here. This hoodie is not doing a goddamn thing. But for video purposes, it's not that cold. Anyway, had a great time last night at the Doubletree. Mo Good, Marlon Mitchell, Jeremiah Frazier, Mike Bonner, myself, and also my guy Dorian Plummer that was in the building. Had a great time, man. Getting ready to head back to Vegas. This is Super Bowl Sunday. Who you going for? I'm going for nobody. I'm just going to watch the game because my team ain't in it. Chicago Bears. Yeah, go. All right. Shut up. I'm trying to do a video. Anyway, so, you get the point. I think it's somebody dead and just the head laying on the horn. Anyway, I'm out. Marsha verse.
And now I want you to meet my youngest son. Please say hello to Skills Hudson. Hey.
Hey.
Skills.
Hello.
How are you? I've heard so much hello. About you.
It is a pleasure, Dr. Silva, Sylvia.
He's choking. You done choked about
Dr. Ooh. Sylvia Traymore. It is a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you.
Doctor, tell us about your doctor.
I got my my degree from some people here in Washington, D.C. that had been watching me, I guess, and they said, we'd like to present you. It was it's a Christian school, and they gave me my honorary doctorate's degree. So oh, wow. That's where the doctor came from.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Who wants to go first and ask Dr. Morrison a question?
Last week, we had a really great conversation with Monique.
Yes.
And, you know, we were talking about sacrifices and things like that that one makes to get where one wants to get. And I was listening to you, and I actually got to meet you at another event with Marsha in Atlanta a few years ago for Hope Flood's
award show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was really moving. And just listening to all the things you have to say about your journey, what does being courageous every day do to mind, body, spirit?
I think there's something in people who are, I guess, like myself, who just don't let, I mean, they're just courageous because it's nothing they can do about it. That's what you're going to do. That's what's inside, you know, for me, it's what's inside me. I'm going to do it. You know, I've had so many disappointments, but I've had so many wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experiences. So I think that I think it's a part of who you are. I do. I think.
And do you feel like you need to refuel, and where do you get your refueling? If you do.
You know, it's crazy, but my audiences, I can't remember an audience that I've been in front of that didn't show incredible love. You know, it's like, so I kind of look forward to that because it's a lonely life. This life for me has been a lonely life. I mean, I've been married and all of that. I have two kids and all of that good stuff. And so I had to maneuver that life into my personal life, and I hope.
Yeah, but I told the story last week of how we were on the Tom Joyner cruise, mm-hmm. and it was Kim Whitley's show, and I was on it, and Alicia Cooper, and you went on and got a standing ovation to start the freaking show, and then left. So that's why we don't have no pictures of you, because you just got your standing ovation and people standing up on the boat, whee, whee, and the next thing we know, you gone somewhere else.
But I ran back around because you know who came and got me was Tisha Campbell. I had been with her mother and her mother's friend all day long, not knowing who she was. I didn't care. We just hit it off.
Okay.
And Tisha Campbell said, I want you to meet my mom. And when she took me to her mom, I said, that is not your mother. You cannot tell me that that's your mother.
Yeah.
And but Marsha, you know what? With respect back to your son, I met Marsha. The first time I met her was in Atlanta at the Hope Flood Awards program.
Oh, okay.
And I could not wait to meet her because my entire professional life, mostly, I'd heard about Marsha Warfield. And then, you know, she blew up. I mean, she did Night Court and did all these. I mean, she was like, there was no way I was going to let her be in Atlanta at an award show. They were giving her a Lifetime Achievement Award. Yeah. I was getting a Lifetime Iconic Award. And I was not leaving Atlanta until Marsha and I met. They were not going to put me out of Atlanta, Georgia until. And when I tell you, I walked over to her. It's Marsha, and I love that she recognizes that we all call her Marsha Warfield. We never call her Marsha. We never call her Miss. No, it's Marsha Warfield. You're going to get Marsha Warfield. And I walked over to her because everybody wanted to take pictures with her. But I said, oh, no, they are not going to do this to me. I have my Marsha Warfield here in Atlanta. They will not keep getting in front of me to take a picture because I'm going to get this picture tonight. This is what I'm saying to myself. And I looked and I was a little nervous because I said, I hope she doesn't think I'm all, you know, creepy and coming over to her and insisting on a picture. And I did. And she was like, of course, I'd be happy to take a picture with you.
Come on, let's get this done.
I said, oh my gosh. So that picture that you have, that's the picture that anybody wants a picture of me and Marsha, I have it because I insisted on it. And I told her that night, I said, I've been waiting to meet you a long time. I'm getting, y'all, I'm real soft, so excuse me. I've been waiting to meet you. Do you know, she's the woman, she and Shirley Hemphill, but it was most, for me, you know, I don't want to disrespect Shirley or anything, but for me, it was Marsha. I needed to talk to Marsha. I needed to let her know.
Well, you can't talk to Shirley.
No, you can't. No.
You can, but she won't answer.
But it was like, if I had a bucket list, my bucket list would have included me having a picture with Marsha, because when you think about, she's the only woman I know who can go back with me with respect to conversations. You know, we can talk about what happened during those, during that late 60s, early 70s type situation. Yeah. So quite naturally, I wanted the picture and I have it for life. My kids know that I have it and that's it. But well, getting back to Monique, Marcia, and fellas, when I met Monique, she, like you guys heard, she said she would always talk about me. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, every single interview that she's done, she'll call me up like she did T.I., she did Shay Shay, she did, I have so many videos of Monique on camera saying, hey, my babies, how you doing, Shook? Let me tell you something right now. You know, and she
oh, that was good.
Yeah, it was.
So yeah, she's been my road dog.
And so where we can see you next?
You know what? Because of the Kennedy Center event right. that I had coming up, my contract called for me not being able to perform, especially with the documentary and the. Right. So I don't have any big shows lined up.
But we're looking for
the replacement. Say it again.
We're looking for the replacement show that you're going to do to replace the one.
Oh, we're working on that right now as we speak. It's either going to, I have people wanting me to do it at the Ford Theater in mm-hmm. Washington because they've redone it. They say it's right. absolutely beautiful. And you got three presidents associated with that. You've got Lincoln, Ford, and who's the third one? The Ford Theater.
Gerald.
Gerald Ford, Abraham Lincoln, and I forgot the third one. But anyway, they say it's absolutely beautiful. But it only seats about 600 people. And they want to have at least 1,000-seater, the producers of this Kennedy Center thing, they want to have at least 1,000 people in the audience for the show. So we're looking at the Warner and the Lincoln Theater here.
Well, we'll be looking forward to it. We'll be looking to see you. We can't thank you enough for dropping by. The door is open.
Oh. What about me, Ma?
What about you? Okay, come on. I'm sorry.
Ma, what are you, Ma?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, but I didn't have a question. What I wanted to do is also give you your flowers, Dr. Sylvia, is that I always loved your work. And then to be on here with you and Mom, I always give Mom her flowers, but but I love you. And what I love about your work is, you know, because I always love impressionists, but you as a Black woman, strong and being able to embody characters so quickly, and not just the voice, but just the mannerisms and everything, and so quickly, certain ones like Dionne Warwick, Michelle Obama, Whoopi Goldberg, what was another one? And Melania Trump.
You've seen the Melania Trump. But you know, I secured Kamala. I've been doing Kamala on stage now, and but in the words of Whoopi Goldberg, let me just say this, because I've been around too. Sylvia and Marcia aren't the only two.
That's right.
That have been around. Okay, so there you have it.
All right.
Thank you for having me. Anytime
the door's open, anytime you want to stay up late and drop by, you're more than welcome.
I will do that. I will do that.
I appreciate you being here. I appreciate all the nice words you said, and I look forward to seeing you in your documentary, in your special.
Well, don't forget, I called you now, and I really wanted you to. I told the people, I said, I need Marcia Warfield. I don't know how we're going to do it, but I need her because I wanted another Black female comic.
Okay, and then I can do my Louise Jefferson impression.
Okay, let's have it.
George.
That's it. Anyway, but you have to flounce when you say it, George. You always flounce. Anyway,
okay,
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We love you and wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good night, honey.
Now, I will be dropping by because I watch your show. I watch this.
All right.
If I don't watch it live, I get it on YouTube.
Drop us a note to come back. Give us a call. You're always welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you, Marcia.
All the best for you.
And in closing for me, just kind of thank you. That's all. I'm just so delighted.
You're more than welcome. You're very.
Look at me.
And I appreciate the compliments you give me. So, you know, it goes around. It's a sisterhood. It's a love thing.
And thank you, Monique. Thank you for all. When you talk to Marcia about me. Look at that. God, dog. You hit me up on the Marcia verse. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, honey.
Okay. I'll see you guys. Yeah. Good night.
You will get it. Yeah, you will get it.
Thank you.
All right. So how is that?
It's history.
You know.
Can I say one thing?
Uh-oh.
It was an amazing show. amazing show.
Who is that, Shaq?
I was trying to do I was trying to do Paul Mooney.
okay. All right. Paul Mooney, Shaq. All right, that's a good deal. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of history that when I talk to people, well, not just in my age bracket, because the history continues, you know, they pick it up at certain places, like Monique. Monique said she started in, what, the 80s, 90s, and I started in the 70s, and there was a gap there that her picking up her story kind of piggybacks, and still, you know, there are gaps for me to fill in because I was doing it during those times. So I think it's interesting to have people who've been in this game, sung or unsung, because they all have put in about the same amount of work. We've all put in the same amount of blood, sweat, and tears, and everybody's worth their due. And I appreciate being able to just talk to them and maybe have some younger people get some encouragement and insight into what they're doing, that it's not wrong. However you follow your dreams, your story is your story. And it's going to, it can only be written by you. So,
hey, Mon, you know what I like, what I found out about her when, because I knew that she had hosted the Muhammad Ali roast, but I didn't know that she had planned to go anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That she said she was planning to just to be up in that, to be up in the building, you know, and to know that attitude as a hungry new comic, you know what I'm saying? And to be around individuals that you admire and everything, and then to get the call to be like, okay, you doing it. What? You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, that was.
I got a few of those stories. I got invited to. Richard Pryor was doing taping for one of his albums and having a after party at the Continental Hyatt House, which was next door to the Comedy Store. And they said, come on up. You can come up too. Well, at that time, I was so broke, I couldn't rub two nickels together if I could find two nickels together. I used to ask people coming out of the Comedy Store for food. Women always have food in their purse, always. So I would ask women if they had any food, and they would say, well, I got a piece of leftover chicken from lunch, give it to me. And so that was one of the ways I was eating. And I had these shoes where the soles were loose, and they flapped, and my pants, the hem was unraveled because they were too short, and they were polyester, so the crease never went away. And I was tacky. I went to that party, and I didn't care. I was going to, you was not going to keep me out of a Richard Pryor after party. And I sat there with my legs crossed and my shoe flapping. And I was embarrassed as all hell, but I was going to do it anyway. And like I said last week, it's not the absence of fear. It's the resolve to do it anyway.
Right.
And that got me, if nothing else, that story and that proximity to Richard Pryor. There ain't no words qualifying enough for him. Anyway.
How many times have you told me that somebody's life can be changed with one phone call? How many times have you told me that?
1 gig. That's all it takes. 1 gig. And you never know when you're going to get it. Some people, like I said, get it at the beginning of their career. Might be your first appearance anywhere. Somebody says, wow, I need that person. You take off. Some people, it doesn't happen until they're in their 80s. You never know. It's the old joke of the guy cleaning up elephant shit in the circus, and he's been doing it 50 years, and his family says, man, when are you going to stop shoveling elephant shit in the circus? He said, what? And give up show business? We just keep on going, because one day somebody's going to see you doing that and say, hey, give me that man. Guy.
Yeah, so, man, come shovel my pit bull shit.
Speaking of shoveling shit for fun and profit, we didn't. But we had a gig together. We raised money for the victims of the Eaton Fire for the charity Letters from Altadena. But we also had a really great show at the Ice House this weekend.
Yes.
Boy, didn't we.
Everybody, it's a beautiful club. The audience was great. You guys showed up, showed out.
It was amazing, Mom.
I had a nice set. The we did a modified Book of Marcia kind of presentation with our old video setup. It really went well, and I'm happy that we got to do it. It was kind of Midnight in the Marcia verse meets the Book of Marcia, then a beautiful club for charity.
With great people. The people at the club were so great, too.
Yes. And the food was good. Everything. The food was good. It's a wonderful club. I would love to do it again, work there again. If you're not coming to see me, you can go. There are other people that are regulars, to get D.L. Hughley and others, go see them, go to the club, support your stand-up comedy. Without you audience, we're just standing in the mirror saying shit to ourselves. That ain't no fun, and it don't pay no bills. So, on that note, Stephen, where will you be this week?
This coming week, you can see me at the Reno Laugh Factory, February 27th through March 2nd. That's the next thing that's coming up for me.
Okay. Well, get your tickets and go see my son.
Yeah.
Skills. Again, where are you going to be?
This Friday and Saturday, I'll be in Houston with Lunel at the Improv, and then back this Sunday and Monday with Kim Whitley at Jimmy Kimmel's.
Okay. Your show is
It's postponed, yes, this week.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm happy to have people come see you. As I said earlier about writing in, there was a couple of letters I wanted to address, but we are way past time. We have a music video playlist that I will include in the comments for some auntie music that you can listen to a little later, or as you listen to us, you might want to play it in low in the background. However, but hopefully it does for you, soothe your savage beast like it does mine. I had the pleasure this week of appearing on Night Court, and it's always nice to revisit Night Court. And Roz was back in the blue and back in my uniform
and really funny. Thank really you. Funny.
I enjoy doing that show as you know, it's the old and the new, it's full circle. It's just a great experience for me. So I'm trying to pack all this whole show into not too long over schedule.
I love you, Christy.
Isn't that sweet? Aww. You want to say something?
I said it already. Oh.
Steven.
I love you, Joseph.
Thank you.
Everybody already know he loved Joseph.
Well, everybody know I love Andy, but hey, boo. But we was talking about you, right? That's why I love you. Anyway, might as well not rush anymore. Make sure you support your local and national Black History Museums, gay music, because they're taking the gay out of LGBT. They're trying to keep us all quiet and keep us all suspicious of each other. So make sure you do what you can to promote humanity. That's all. Humanity. You don't have to give it a name. Just every person deserves to live their life openly, freely, and as long as they ain't hurt nobody. In the words of Rodney King, can we all get along? Thank you for watching, and I hope to see you again next week. And until then, have a wonderful time. Love you. Bye-bye. Marsha.
Got a way no one can do it like that. Her own style, no one can wear that hat. Hey, don't you know that the queen is back? She's back, she's back. She withstands the test of time. When it comes to strength, she comes to mind. Get down, she gets back up.